Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who nearly killed a woman in the audience yesterday. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Love to see you. Thank you for coming, everyone. You're small but perfectly formed. Very nice to see you. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to Angela Rippon from off of Master Team yesterday. Who remembers Master Team? That's my mate. I used to... Oh, she was great on that. No one remembers Master Team. I used to eat my... It was on between 1985 and 1987. I used to eat my tea watching it with my mum, and it was through a period where my mum was making a lot of soups and stews. And that's what I think of... I can't remember anything about the quiz, but Angela Rippon... Anyway, I saw her yesterday. She's doing well. She calls it Rehullister, but anyway, so it's like it's, I was in Harpenden yesterday doing an afternoon gigs about Morecambe and Wise. This Eric Morecambe Centre has been set up in Harpenden, and Robin Ince asked me to come along and talk about Morecambe and Wise as a double act. And we sort of this afternoon gig. We'd been moved to the function room because we hadn't sold enough tickets in the theatre. Shame there isn't a function room in this place, isn't it? And that last time I'd been involved, I went to the theatre where Eric Morecambe died. I had a gig in Tewkesbury, I think it is. Is that right? And not enough people came to that, and we were moved into the bar. So I think Eric Morecambe's got something against me in the heavenly realm. That's where I met Angela Rippon, who was doing a different thing. But in our little, in our function room, about 50 minutes into this hour-long chat, a woman in the front row said, "I think there's something wrong with this lady." And there was a woman in the front row. It was quite an elderly audience. I'd already spotted a bloke in the third row who was sleeping. So people just come in out of the cold. But she'd gone right back, and her head was right back, and her eyes had gone. And I thought she'd gone. I thought we'd lost her. We stopped the gig, but she, out of respect for her past soul. But she came back alive again and was okay. She was okay. I don't think she died through laughter, is what I would say. She died through boredom, if that had happened. So it's a bit of a shame. And also, I've had a very full weekend. On Saturday, I went to, it was my mother-in-law's birthday, and my wife, for some reason, decided a good present for my mother-in-law would be a speedboat ride on the Thames. And should I take us, my 7-year-old and my 4-year-old son, and her dad, who when last time was on a cruise, had to get off because it was he couldn't cope with a cruise ship moving over the sea. And so we did. Speedboats aren't really my thing. I'm not really into the adrenaline stuff like my guest today. And it was all slow to begin with. It was nice, but once we got past the Tower Bridge, it went at full pelt, and it was really fast. And it was jumping up and down and hitting the waves, and it was going to the side and to the side. Luckily, my son was going, "I don't like it, I don't like it." So he had to stop and go slowly. But I really was just—it's been the most delight I'd have had to have a child. I have to say. It's finally they have a use, because I was fucking bricking it, I have to tell you. Look, before we go on, I should thank the Kickstarter people who have backed this in order to get a mention. John Walker backed us. He says, 25 years an MS warrior and still shuffling. I'm assuming that's multiple sclerosis, but it might be Marks and Spencer's. I don't know. It's either way, but well done, John. Jim Parkin also is another big supporter of the podcast. He doesn't want anything said. David Smith, I haven't read this. Let's see what he says. I'd like Richard to dedicate the episode to my cockapoo, Beans. Beans is a wonderful dog and a regular listener of Rahalastapa. Thank you. And I'd like him and all your listeners to know I think he's a good boy, the best boy. That is, he says, feel free to be offensive. I'm not going to be offensive to Beans, a little cockapoo. What has my life become? It's amazing. Right, look, my guest this week is going to be a fantastic show, I can tell you. He's probably best known for his appearance on the Podge and Rod show. Yeah. Though he was also, of course, Dungeon Master on Tucker's Luck. And I think we should talk to him about that for an hour. Will you please welcome The Universe May Be Destroyed. This is the first time we've ever met. Been in the same room. Some people think we look like each other. It's crazy. Will you please welcome the amazing Charlie Borman, ladies and gentlemen? Here he is. Fine. It's Charlie Borman. It's a mirror. It's a mirror. Who put a mirror? Who put a mirror down the centre?
You're just my chubby brother.
I thought you were tall. Someone told me you were really tall, so I thought when you came out it would be funny because you'd be tall. But you're the same height as me as well, more or less.
Well, a little taller, but not that it really matters. And we were checking each other's penises in the changing room as well.
Yeah. Yours is very small, Charlie, yes. Well, our genitals are quite similar. There's a lot of similarities. We'll get into that later.
Well, we've only got two between us, haven't we? So,
yes.
So two balls we should be known as.
Two balls, but you've lost a ball and I've lost a ball for the same cause. We've been talking about it this afternoon for another podcast. You lost your right one as well. I lost my right one as well. No good. We could have had a full set.
I know. It could have been handy, actually. But I have a false testicle,
yes.
And you don't. So I've got a little rubber one, and it's and when I was in Jordan a few years ago, and I was floating around in the Dead Sea, and it floats so much that when I was swimming, it kept flipping me over. And this little hairy testicle just kept popping out of the water. So I've got a life jacket attached to me. So I'm good. So if we were at the Titanic, you'd be fucked and I'd be fine.
I'd just hold on to you. It'd be fine. There are a few weird coincidences. Like I've been mistaken for you a few times by people who insist that I am you, even when I say I don't know what they're talking about. So a guy literally came up to me in a club and said, "Well done on the long way round." And I went, "I don't know what that is." And he said, "You know, when you motorbike around the world with Ewan McGregor." And you go, "No, I don't." that isn't ringing any bell. Like, oh, yeah, that time. Yeah, how had I forgotten that? And also, I'm interested in, you got the gig advertising Herring shoes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, how did you get that?
Do you like those shoes?
I do. I actually buy stuff from Herring shoes, partly because they've got Herring written all over them. Also, my name is Herring, and I look like you. Why did they get you to do it? Not, did you get
well,
that?
You're the sort of ugly brother, I suppose, that you know, they need someone to sell it. I don't know why I got those. He saw me wearing them in some thing, and they got in contact with me and said, would you like some shoes? And you know.
Yeah.
Of course, don't want to buy shit, do you, really?
It should be me.
It should be, I know. Well, listen, I'll put a word in. Actually, I tried already, and he said who?
I presume it's the same firm. Well, we used to, when our school coach would go to Stratford-on-Avon, we'd pass a shop called Richard Herring Shoes, and everyone in the coach was saying, Richard Herring shoes. So I'm presuming it's the same guys, but there is a Richard Herring involved in that company, I believe. Also, we both love motorcycling around. It's me turning the handles to make it go, Charlie. That's Kawasaki 792. That's my baby. So that's what I've got. So we've got a lot of... Have you ever been mistaken for me? Has anyone mistaken you for me?
No, I'm sorry. I've got to be truthful. there's a guy called Henry Cole who looks a bit like you as well, okay. Actually. We could be triplets. He rides motorbikes as well. And people come up to me and they say, I said, I loved your show when you rode through New Zealand. And I go, that wasn't me. I go, that was Henry. I said, you've just insulted me.
I find it insulting that people compare me to you, Charlie. So it's okay.
I don't blame them. I wouldn't want to be me. I spend most of my time not wanting to be me.
Oh, that's not fair. That's not nice. Well, it's absolutely lovely to meet you. We have had a good chat about our ball. There are balls in plural between the two of us. So That's a good thing. But look, there's so much. I mean, I hadn't, like, forgotten, but of course you have this amazing, as well as all the motorcycling stuff that you're probably best known for now, you've got all this amazing acting work you did, mainly as a younger man. They're still doing a bit of acting every now and again, or does it come up?
Yeah, I haven't done so much. I mean, well, my father's a film director.
Yeah.
And he's a guy called John Borman, and he directed films like Deliverance, Excalibur, and Hope and Glory, and Emerald Forest, and lots and lots of movies. And I've got three sisters, and so there's four of us. And so whenever Dad was making a movie and there was a part for a kid in it, he would say, don't employ any children. I've got four free ones. so we were just thrown into movies. So the first movie I was in was, has anyone seen Deliverance here?
With
Burt Reynolds and stuff.
Yeah.
And so my father said to me, he said, Charlie, look, if you sit on that sofa with that bloke, I'll give you a tricycle. It sounded really dodgy, but I wanted the tricycle. So at the end of the movie, when John Voight comes back to his wife at the end of the movie, there's a little boy sitting on a sofa. And so that was me. And so that's where it kind of went from. And then, you know, we were always thrown into his movies. And I played one of the characters in Excalibur.
Yeah.
Mordred, and had a nice suit of gold armor and rode a horse. It was brilliant. And it kind of went from there, really. And I'm really heavily dyslexic. So school was always a nightmare for me, and in school I was always in the school plays, and that was really the only place I felt like I could express myself, and so I think my father saw that, you know, there was no point going to university, so I left school at 16,
yeah.
and I went off and I was making movies and had some success in the sort of 80s and 90s.
Yeah, well, The Emerald Forest is a great film as well, which you're the star of The Emerald Forest.
Yeah, I had to sleep with my father for 17 years to get that part.
Well, it's a weird, because it's a film in which your characters sort of ended up living with tribes in South America. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you become, like, part of the tribe. But there's a lot of nudity in it and some
sauciness. Yeah, I mean, 17, there was a lot of naked girls as well. It was like... Wow, you know,
but
and
your
going
dad
straight from boarding school to there, it was brilliant.
But your dad's directing it, was that a bit weird having your dad?
It's funny, isn't it? You know, a lot of, I think at the beginning of the movie when I got the part, there was lots of this sort of talk of nepotism and you know, the people say, oh, he's only got the part because he's, you know, because of his dad and stuff. And so I think Dad was always much harder on me whenever I was in any of his movies. He was to sort of make it, I had to be better than I needed to be in order to sort of, you know, stop that. But then I remember sort of, I think a week into the show, I got absolutely blind drunk and the crew had to carry me home. And so the ice broke on that bit. So,
yeah.
So, but it is, it's always tougher when the door sort of opens for you, you know, you can go in, but you know, if you do get the job, then you usually tend to have to work a little bit harder.
Yeah, and a movie, and if you're carrying, I mean, it's a different sitting on a couch in Deliverance that you weren't going to wreck that film. Yeah. But
I didn't get picked. Imagine if I'd taken points on that movie, I'd have been a millionaire.
But it also, I think I saw that film before I knew there was any relationship between the two. And you're very excellent in it.
Well, it's very kind. But no, I mean, it was funny growing up in Ireland because we grew up in the middle of the countryside in Ireland and in the middle of the nowhere. And then sort of every two or three years, we'd go off to California or go to Georgia or go to the South Pacific or Brazil or wherever it was that Dad was making a movie.
Yeah.
And whether or not we were in it or not, we were just these kids who kind of went along. So there was always people kind of hanging around the house and, you know, I'd go out and knock about on motorbikes and then come back for lunch and there'd be a table full of people. I had no idea who they were. They were just eating all my food and take, but so it was great fun. So we either lived in the middle of nowhere or we were on a film set. So it was kind of bizarre.
Yeah.
But, and then, you know, all of Dad's friends, like, you know, the reason Dad got into America was because he made a film called Catch Us If You Can with the Dave Clark Five. I don't know if you ever remember them. They were sort of a flash in the pan band. And they did that song, Catch Us If You Can.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a famous film song. Anyway, by the time he made the movie, Dave Clark Five were finished. And so that didn't really help his film. But Lee Marvin saw that movie.
Okay.
And he was the biggest box office at the time.
Yeah.
And he came up to my dad and said, I want you to direct my next movie. And that was a film called Point Blank, which is, if you haven't seen it, it's a fantastic film. Yeah. And so Dan went off to the States and they became friends. They made a couple of movies together and he became my godfather of all people. He was a shit godfather. I mean, he was drunk most of the time. And I don't think he ever once bought me a present.
Never sent you a book token.
Never sent me a book token. But he was an amazing guy. I mean, he fought in the South Pacific in the Second World War. He was a US Marine and he saw proper action. I think he drank because when they were in the South Pacific, they were led into an ambush and his whole battalion were wiped out except for him and his mate. And not a lot of people know this, but he was shot in the ass. And you know, being a Marine, that suggests you were running away. You know? But it was a ricochet and he was on the ground and his friend came back, got him, carried him out.
Wow.
And so he was always a bit loose.
Yes.
I do remember one funny story about him. Well, there's quite a few really. But anyway, this one in particular. So Point Blank had just come out and was a big success. And he, so they were at Malibu Pier on the beach. There was a famous restaurant there that everybody would eat at. And so my dad and my mum and my two older sisters and Pam, his wife, his first wife, were there and Lee was hammered drunk and it was his car and Dad said, look, Lee, give me the keys to the car, you're too drunk to drive. And Lee wouldn't give him the car. So they had this tussle, and Lee's 6'3" and Dad's my height. And anyway, Dad got the keys and he ran to the car and got the driver's car and he locked the door and Mum and my sisters all dived into the car as well. And everyone rolled up their windows and Lee was shaking the car and he wouldn't get in. And then he finally climbed up onto the roof of the car. And he wouldn't get off the roof of the car. And Dad thought, God, he's going to be here all night. So he thought, well, it's only a mile down the PCH. Now, PCH is Pacific Coast Highway. It's one of the busiest roads in Los Angeles. And it runs all the way along the coast up to San Francisco. So he got in the car, and Lee's still on the roof of the car, and he gets onto the road, and he turns down. He's going down about 200 meters down the road, and there's a police bike coming up the other way. And the police bike sees this, and he puts the lights on, chases my father, pulls him over and you can imagine Lee, his concentration is now on the policeman. And I mean, the foul language that was coming out of his mouth, and the policeman completely ignored him. He walked up to the car and he knocked on the window of the car and Dad rolled down the window thinking, fucking hell. And the guy leans in and he goes, sir, do you realize you have Lee Marvin on the roof of your car? And my father says, well, yes, I do. And he goes, okay, that's fine, sir. Have a nice evening. And off he went. So he was a fun man to be around.
Yeah,
he really was.
Amazing. Yeah, it must be so incredible to, you know, with that, when you're not even really aware of necessarily who those people, as a kid, would be surrounded by all those people. But I also read that you were the first male to hold Angelina Jolie.
I was. But I mean, it doesn't sound as amazing as it sounds. That's like, you make it sound.
Yeah.
Great. It was. I was a page boy at their wedding, and so she was dumped into my hands, crying.
Right. Someone must have held her before that,
well,
you were a
parents, uncles, aunts.
I've kind of imagined you were at the birth somehow. She popped out.
Catching.
You delivered her.
Hey, I'm first.
Oh, that's nice. So yeah, when she was a baby, you held Angelina Jolie. Does she remember? Have you met her since?
No, not a clue. No. And but I must say that Angelina's mother, Micheline, is one of the most beautiful. I remember I was only 9 and I was completely and utterly besotted by her. I thought she was just the most beautiful person on earth.
Right. Oh, that's lovely. Very nice. What about Tucker's Luck? Do you remember being in Tucker's Luck? That's the big one.
I did the Emerald Forest and travelled around the world promoting the movie. And then my next job was Tucker's Luck. I was dungeon master in Tucker's Luck.
What's Todd Carty like in real life? Is he
really
nice? Did you ever drive around with him?
Really nice guy, actually. Yeah. And I keep bumping into him, you know, every so often. And he's always comes up and says hello. And he's a proper fella.
It's good. Do you remember being on the Podge and Rod show? Do you know what it is?
I don't remember the Podge and Rod show. No,
it
I don't.
Should be more memorable. I think it's an Irish puppet show of some
kind. Oh, the Podge. Oh, yeah. No, that's quite loose as well. Well, yeah. They do a nighttime version.
Oh, do they?
And I think it was an evening one. Yeah, okay. And they were quite rude. It was brilliant, actually. That was good. And they'd ply you with Guinness and get you drunk and then throw you out in front of the camera. So it was nice.
Good. And the other thing, I wanted to ask you from Wikipedia, which is not necessarily the greatest of sources, were you in Alien?
No. I've been asked it a lot. No, I think, but lots of people say, "Oh, your dad directed Alien," and
right.
I say, "No, no, he didn't," and they go, "Yes, he did." No, he didn't. That was Ridley. You know.
Okay, so you didn't, because it says that you and Ridley Scott's son were. I mean, I'm not telling you were in it.
No.
If you're saying you weren't.
No, it definitely wasn't in
it.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's on Wikipedia.
That's Wikipedia.
What can Wikipedia say? So when the sort of the acting sort of, you ended up sort of being a painter and decorator in between acting jobs?
Yeah, my acting career went really downhill. I mean, I had some success with The Emerald Forest in 84, 85.
Yeah.
And then I did a number of films on that. But I kept choosing films for their location. So, you know, they said, "Oh, this film's shooting in Africa," and I'd take it. And then I'd read the script on the plane on the way there, and I'd think, "Fucking hell, this is shit." But it's a great location. And I was obsessed by travel and by people and the people that you meet in these different countries. And I think I probably got that from my father. My father had a reputation for being a guy who makes movies in really difficult locations and tough filmmaker. And I think I got that sense of travel and being in those kind of difficult places, and I loved it. And watching Dad thrive in those situations was great. I mean, he was quite a tough. He had a terrible reputation of being quite tough. He used the C word all the time. And you know, you'd be sitting there, especially when you're young, about 13 on set, and suddenly you hear him screaming and shouting and saying, firing people all over the place, and you're thinking, "Oh, God," and just wanting to just sort of shrivel up and run away, you know.
Has he settled down in old age?
He has. He's 89 now.
Yeah.
And he wrote 3 books in COVID and a script.
Right.
And so, yeah, he wrote a lovely book called Conclusions, his sort of last chapter of his life. And he says, "I don't think I'll have time for more." He said. So, but he's an amazing guy. I mean, his body kind of sort of has let him down a little bit, but his mind is just incredible.
That's great.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And you, but you met Ewan on a film, so you got it was up and down, right? Acting career, so it wasn't.
Oh no, it was tough. I mean, because I was going to all these different countries, and the films weren't that great. They were becoming less and less.
Yeah.
And I was whenever I did a film, because I've been dyslexic, I really struggled learning lines, and I just found it incredibly difficult, and it used to completely stress me out. And so I was sort of going off acting because of that,
right?
And doing theatre and having to learn a whole play was just. I would have to start months ahead to learn the lines, and it was awful. But anyway, so I was sort of doing less and less, and I'm doing more and more painting and decorating, and I married and I had a couple of kids, and then you know, the films became less and less, and I was then doing more and more kind of proper building work, and at some point I thought, you know, this is probably where I'm going to be now, and I felt it was quite frustrating, really, because. I still felt I wanted to travel. I wanted to do more, you know.
Yeah.
And then I did this film called The Serpent's Kiss with Ewan, and it had Pete Postlethwaite, Greta Scacchi, Richard E. Grant, Ewan McGregor, and myself. And I thought, this is brilliant. I'm back. You know, this is my comeback film. Anyway, we had a brilliant time doing it. The film was absolute shit. And it went straight to DVD, and I'm not even sure if anybody bought the DVD. I mean, it was an awful film. But I met Ewan,
and we
both had our first children at the same time. They were both about 6 or 7 months old when we did the movie together, and we just hit it off. I remember the first conversation I had with Ewan was all about motorcycles, and he had a Moto Guzzi California, and we spoke about that, and then, you know, here we are 25 years later, and we're still talking about motorbikes. That's about it, really. I was talking to him last night, and he was just, "Oh, Charlie, I just got this new bike. What do you think?" And I love the whole thing of Zoom and or just talking to WhatsApp on your phone. It connects people from all over the world, doesn't it? Anyway, so and then we ran motorbike race teams together. We did track days together. We did all sorts of stuff together. And then eventually, Ewan. And then we used to go sort of on long weekends together, and then we thought we'd do a longer trip and go down to the south of France, meet our kids and wives there, ride down, ride back, you know, for a bit of adventure. And then Ewan rang me up and he said, "Charlie, better come over to the house. I've got this idea." And we came over, and there was this big map on the table, and it was a map of the world. And he said, "Look, why don't we, instead of forget Spain, let's go to China." I went, "Ooh, okay." And then we thought, well, if we get to China, what about Mongolia? And then we kind of thought, well, we may as well go to New York. And our wives were sort of just looking at us and thinking, well, they were going, how long is that going to take? And we kind of worked it out that it was going to be about 4.5 months. And they both didn't bat an eyelid about it at all. I said to Ollie afterwards, I said, "Ollie, well, you're not worried that we're going off for 4.5 months? She goes, "No, I think you'd be right."
Sounds like they want to get rid of you.
Yeah, probably. I mean, nowadays, you know, since lockdown, you know, now that we're kind of the world's opening up again, I keep seeing my suitcase at the front door. So he's sort of going, "Come on, go," you know.
And so, were going to do it anyway, and then thought, "Let's turn it into a TV show," or was the TV show a part of the mix at that point?
It was, you know, we were going to do it, and then I didn't really have the money to do it. You know, Ewan. I was, you know, painter, decorator, two wife, two kids, a mortgage. You know, I just didn't have the money. And Ewan had just finished Star Wars, so he was minted. But being Scottish, I probably wasn't going to get any of that. So then someone mentioned about a book and said that what they thought would make a really nice book. You know, two great friends going off traveling around the world, and so we approached some book people and said. And that actually was quite easy to get a book. And because you go there, and because the pitch was that we're going to go from here to here, not really sure what's going to happen, but I'm sure it'll be all right. And,
yeah.
And the book people thought, God, that's great, two friends, lots is going to happen and stuff like that. So we got that. And then we walked. I remember walking out of the publishers and having this book deal, and I'm thinking, well, that's great, but I can't fucking read, let alone write. I had no idea how we're going to do it. And Ewan's, you know, just as bad as I am. So then we thought we would do these video diaries, and we would get someone to help us write the book. And we both knew exactly what we wanted from the book.
Yeah.
And so this guy would then help us, and then we thought, well, if we're going to do video diaries, we may as well film it. Yeah. And then it kind of sort of snowballed from there. But getting the TV show was, we still didn't have a TV deal until, I think, you know, 3 weeks before we were leaving. Right. And we'd already started filming the preparation and all this kind of stuff. It was when we were doing the leaving party that my brother-in-law, James, who was working for Sky at the time, and they'd already passed on it, or he passed on it. Mm. And then when we had the leaving party, we were showing a reel of stuff that we'd filmed. We were just showing stuff of it. And he suddenly got the idea of it. And he said, right, tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, the contract would be at your door. So like 3 weeks before we leave, we got the TV deal. But when we were in Australia, we flew over to Australia. Ewan was making a second Star Wars there. And we went to make a little pilot because people just weren't getting the idea. Anyway, so while we're there, we thought we'd go to one of the TV stations and pitch the idea to them. Anyway, we went to this one place, Channel 8 or 10, or I can't remember. Anyway, we're sitting and we did this pitch, and we're going to go around the world in these motorbikes, and we're going to meet people along the way, and it's going to be really exciting. Anyway, we finished the pitch and we said, you know, what do you think? And he said, do you want to know what I really think? And we said, yeah, and we'd really like to. And he goes, I think two wankers on motorcycles. And that was it. Anyway, the year later, we sold it to them for a fortune. So fuck them. But yeah, so it was a really odd. And then, you know, there was no reason why it would be successful. I mean, it just... You know,
was there really no planning? You say you knew where you were going to go, obviously, but the reason
there was plan. There's always, if you do a big trip like that where you have multiple countries that you're going to go to, you've got to, in some of the countries you have to do carnets, and you have to, like we're going to all have to do now just to go to fucking France. We're going to have a carnet for our it's a nightmare. But so we had to have that, and I think if you're going to do a big trip, I certainly wouldn't. Plan it to the nth degree, but I would certainly look at the route where you're going to go, and then sort of within each of those countries think of what you'd really like to do in those countries.
Yeah.
And then you just, you know, connect the dots and off you go. So it's kind of, and that's kind of the way we did it. We wanted it to be as authentic as possible.
Yeah, and I suppose it's most people don't travel in that way. So most of us, if we are going to China, would fly to China.
Yeah, I mean, flying so, I mean, flying is fine because you leave an airport that looks like an airport, and then you land in an airport that looks like an airport. And, you know, if you land and take off and land in America, I don't know if you've done lots of traveling in America, but I think all the airports are made by the same person.
Right.
And I was flying all over the place at one stage, and I was standing in this airport, and I couldn't remember what city I was in, because
right.
I was thinking, no, I've just left Chicago, but this looks like Chicago. Oh, it was just so. It's a very different experience when you fly in somewhere, as opposed to being on time. It's like when you and I went down through Sudan and then went from Sudan into Ethiopia. You know, so we went down the Nile, and it's stunning, and it's very deserty and dry, and I mean, it's just beautiful, And then you got to the Ethiopian border, and it was literally like on a map. There's a line, and just on the other side of the border, everything changed. It was wood. It was green. And then when you change, you know, all the tarmac color changes. The color of the paint on the road changes. The way the dashes on the road are different. The signposts different. The architecture. The way people dress.
Yeah.
It's just the most extraordinary way of travelling. It's brilliant.
And I guess you just get an idea of even looking at a map, it's hard to get the idea of the scale of the world or even how far. I mean, in a globe, it's not even really accurate in terms of distance. So
no, yeah, the maps are all distorted a little bit. So Africa always looks a bit smaller than, I mean, Africa is a fucking big place.
Yeah.
And especially when you travel through it, you just think, oh my God, it's like going across Australia. You know, when you fly home from Sydney, you know, the first 5 hours you're flying over Australia, you know, but you look at it on a map and it's just a little island down at the bottom of the globe.
Yeah.
So it's the best way in the world to travel.
And it's what you said earlier, is it that it's about the people you are meeting along the way, and you know, people are, I mean, not everyone would have recognized even who you are.
Well, they certainly wouldn't have recognized me.
They wouldn't
have
recognized from the Emerald Forest.
But they would have recognized. I know. I used to keep dropping my trousers. and in fact, that was the only time I ever got an award for my acting career. Was I was voted in Germany. I was voted best bum of the year.
Oh, that's not bad.
And being, you know, being an actor with a big ego, I went to collect it.
But you know, even Star Wars isn't everywhere, right? Is that what some people wouldn't have?
Yeah, I remember one time we were in Tangier and we went to one of those troglodyte places where they filmed the original Star Wars in those, you know, in those sunken things. So Ewan goes, I don't want to go there because I'm just going to get mobbed. You know, and anyway, we went. Then he had a big beard, admittedly, but we went around and we were walking around and not a single person. And eventually I said, Ewan, stand by that poster of you. And he was standing by the post of him, and he had a beard in the film. And he was standing by the post, and people were just walking by. And I like to think that because it was so hot that people's brains were just fried, and just didn't make it. And we were pissing ourselves with laughter. And he was going, these aren't the bikes you're looking for.
I mean, you wouldn't think it would be really him, I suppose. Maybe that.
But, you know, I mean, I think once you get to Eastern Europe and start getting into Kazakhstan and Mongolia and Siberia and Far East Russia and all those places, you know, people are spending much more time just getting along and just living, you know, and it's a very different, you know, we're very lucky here in the West and this sort of opulent kind of lifestyles that we all have and everything's on our fingertips. Whereas, you know, you don't have to travel very far to see that it all gets a bit harder.
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing way to get perspective on people. But I've heard you saying that 99% of people in the world are good people.
They are good.
And you know,
it's the, you know, you asking me that question, you know, would you be happy with 6 and 7 year olds running your country?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, yes, I would. But it is true, you know, that I think if you look at Iran, I spent a bit of time making a TV show in Iran, and it's one of the nicest places you'll ever travel through. And people are lovely and they're very funny. Everyone speaks English. Everyone's really well educated. The food is amazing. And then you've got, you know, these nutters who are looking after the place and they don't reflect the people. You know, and it's the same in most countries. You know, it's these nutters who are, you know, like Putin at the moment. You know, he's just had a bit of power for a bit too long, hasn't he? Really,
yeah.
And but was it ultimate power ultimately corrupts? So
yeah, well, he definitely has. That seems to be the case in this. But you mean you've sort of been everywhere, right? There's so many different series you've done anyway.
Yeah.
But even with the three with Ewan, you've sort of nearly been everywhere. So is it giving you a perspective on the world as a whole? Is there a place that you prefer, or is it just the fact that you're going to all these different places?
I think I'm a big fan of the African continent. I think Kenya and Uganda, Rwanda and Tanzania, Malawi and all those places are just, I think it's the most magical place in the world. It's the only continent in the world where there's actually any wildlife left. And everything and every other continent you've been to, it's all just been killed off. And so I do motorcycle tours from Cape Town to Victoria Falls. Once a year we take a bunch of people on motorbikes and we go through South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe and we go on all these safaris and we stay in these beautiful lodges and I mean, stunning places. And you know, there's where else in the world can you be going running on a motorbike and you have to stop because 40 elephants are crossing the road, and yeah. you're just and you're going, this is the third time today, for fuck's sake, you know. And you actually get, if I see another fucking elephant, you know, and it's amazing. And the giraffe, and you wake up in the morning, and there's one hotel we stay in where it has these little cottages around this watering hole. And you wake up at 6 a.m. and sunrise, and you look down at the watering hole, and there's a lion or a giraffe or a hippo. It's just beautiful, and the people are just magical as well. It's a lovely part of the world.
Sure. So you obviously like the adrenaline. I mean, I don't like the adrenaline of going fast. I've been on a speedboat this weekend, and it made me sad.
Actually, I was thinking when you were talking about a speedboat of the Thames, we were. Up the Thames with a friend of mine who's got a speedboat and we were herring along and then we ran out of petrol and so we managed to get to the side where there's one of those police stations on the thing, and we get off there and I get the petrol can and I go to get a taxi to go to a petrol station, and I'm thinking, I just hope I don't meet anybody that I know, because it's been quite embarrassing having run out of petrol on a boat. It's the last thing you want to do. Anyway, so I hail this taxi down, get in the taxi, and he goes, oh, hi, Charlie. And I look at him, and it's a mate of mine who I go dirt bike riding with in Wales. Right. I mean, how can that be? Anyway, then by the time I got home, I had friends texting going, oh, so you ran out of petrol on the Thames, did you? And, oh, man, it was just... Anyway... I love all that speed and adrenaline and
yeah, and you're not like you've it. Had some quite a lot of accidents. I mean, as many accidents, I would say maybe you shouldn't be getting on motorbikes, but you've had some you've had serious accidents.
Yeah, the last 4 years, 5 years has been quite bad.
Yeah,
I've had lots of accidents in the past because of running motocross bikes and enduro bikes, so that's part of the whole part and parcel. But in 2016, I got clipped by a car in Portugal and smashed my legs to pieces.
Yeah.
And that was quite bad. And that was 17 operations to get those back together. And that took 2 years. And I had big cages on my leg and stuff like that. But but my daughter caught me. I was heading out the door with this big cage. It was complicated because I broke both legs at the same time, which means you can't really get about. So... you know, pooping and going to the toilet was always an issue. And because you were taking a lot of morphine, you know, you just get bunged up. So it's just either you just can't shit or you do shit and it's really painful. And now I kind of have a sense of what childbirth is like. But anyway, so my right ankle was better, so I could get on in crutches. So I was sneaking out the door because I decided that I could. Could have this big cage around here, this, you know, those external cages holding your leg together. And I thought, I'm thinking I could get, because I couldn't get on my normal motorbike because the cage, I couldn't get my foot close enough to change gear. So I thought, well, I can't ride that unless I put a little extension on the gear changer and then, you know, to make it longer. Anyway, all that was going on in my mind. And then I thought, well, I can get on my wife's scooter. So I'm sneaking out the door and my daughter comes, suddenly appears at the door and she goes, where are you going? And I said, Ollie said that her scooter, there was something wrong with the front brake. And she goes, why do you need the helmet? And this sort of thing. And eventually I said, look, I'm just going for a quick ride. Okay. Anyway, I went off and got on the bike and I could ride the motorbike because it's just twist and go. And then, because I hadn't ridden a motorbike for like a year and a half, I was going along the road in Barnes. And all these cars and everyone was just flying past me. And I'm thinking, fucking hell, in a year and a half now, everyone's driving like nutters. Anyway, I looked down and I was doing 11 miles an hour thinking, this is really fast. Anyway, so that... but there were all sorts of things on that one. So, you know, the biggest goal, apart from wanting to get back on a motorbike after these accidents, after smashing my legs, and it was always... The focus was always... to get back on a motorbike. And I think that's what kind of kept my mental health so right. well, was because I had a purpose. I had a goal to get to. But my first goal was to sit on a toilet. That was my first goal. And I'd get in the wheelchair and I'd be scooting along, and under the stairs is a little toilet under the stairs, and just a tiny little, just a toilet and a sink, and you have to go down two steps to sit in this toilet. I would go along, and I keep looking at it, thinking, God, I'm sure there's a way of. Anyway, I figured out there was a way of. I thought I'd give it a go, and I took the wheelchair to the front, the first two steps of the steps going up to the upstairs, and there was a little landing bit, so I managed to get off the wheelchair, and I put my bum on the landing, and then I put my bum down onto the floor, and I shuffled my way to the toilet, and I put my legs in first, and then I thought, what I'll do is I'll hinge up on this better leg, and pull my trousers down and swing around, sit on the toilet, yeah, and take a poop, and it'd been like a year, you know. And so I did that. So I went around and got my trousers down. But as I sat in the toilet, I missed the toilet. And I wedged myself between the... Because the wall was really close. I wedged myself between the toilet and the thing. And I was stuck in this edge thing like this. And I'm thinking, what the fuck am I going to do now? And my other daughter walked past. I remember, I always forget, she had her laptop and she was looking at something. And she just looked down and she said, what the fuck are you doing there? And just walked off. And I said, can you help? And she said, no. And I've somehow managed to pull myself up, finally sat on the toilet. And I tell you, I must say, that was probably the best poop I've ever had in all my life. But it was, but there were loads of little milestones like that. It's quite difficult when there were life-changing results of it. So my ankle and my legs don't work so well anymore. I can walk and stuff, but I can't walk very far. I can't climb mountains anymore. I can't, you know, I look at people, my daughter runs up the stairs on the telephone, I think, bitch. I just could never do that again, you know, right, and stuff like that. So there's lots of things that have happened, but as you recover, you know, you have the big goal, but you have these little milestones as you go along, and I think you know, you need them, and it can be very difficult sometimes, you know, you're sitting there, and I was sleeping downstairs, and because I couldn't get upstairs for such a long time, and sometimes, you know, because you're lying around all day, you don't necessarily sleep so well.
Sure.
At night, you know, and you wake up in the middle of the night, and that's when all the kind of the bad things go around in your head, and then you finally nod off again, and then you wake up and you think all the rubbish that you were thinking in the middle of the night, and scary stuff. But
yeah.
But I think often you spend a lot of time sort of thinking about. What if, should I, could I, should have done that. Maybe if I left the hotel 5 minutes, a minute later,
yeah,
it would never have happened and stuff. And then you've got to sort of catch yourself because no matter what you could have done, it doesn't make any difference because it's happened and
yeah,
there's nothing you can do to change it. So you're best to just park that trauma and not let it define you and move on. And I think part of my healing was when I woke up the next day in hospital in Portugal, and both my legs were in plaster, and I'd broken my hand as well. So I was sitting there and I only had one hand left. And I'm thinking, fucking hell, this is bad. And I was really excited, really sorry for myself. And then I kind of realized there was another patient in the room, and I looked over and there was another guy in the bed beside me, and he was in a terrible way. And in much, much worse than I was. And I remember looking over at him, and I remember looking at myself, and I remember actually feeling quite cheery by the whole thing and thinking, actually, this is not so bad.
They probably just employ that guy to go, yes, they're quite badly injured. Yeah. Let's get in the cast, full body cast. It's better than Patch
it's
Adams.
This guy. Yeah.
But it is interesting that the after that, and I know the accident was, you know, you were avoiding it, so someone else's fault, wasn't it? You were avoiding
still
your car.
Still, it's but on a motorbike. It's still kind of your fault. You should have seen it coming, you know.
But the fact that you wanted to go, that the impetus to get better was to go back on the bike, is kind of, I mean,
dumb.
It's kind of crazy, but I mean, it's sort of it's. That's how much you love the. And you've had subsequent accidents as well. Yeah, beyond this one.
But I think it's the same with someone who loves. If you, I'm sure you guys know someone who rides horses as well, and they'll always say they've broken a leg or an arm or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And they still get back on the horse but I think I think the pleasure of being on a motorcycle, and I think it's a real, you know, everyone talks about mindfulness now, don't they? And about, you know, about your state of health. And we were talking about it earlier about testicular cancer and having cancer and having to deal with it. And the more you talk about it, the less of a problem it becomes.
Sure.
You know, there's that great line in Crocodile Dundee when they say, well, how do you deal with problems? He goes, well, such and such tells Wally, and then Wally tells everybody, and then there's no more problem. You know, which is, to a degree, is quite true. Yeah. You know, the more you talk about it. So I think, and then when you ride a motorbike, the idea of having had a stressful day at work and you've got your 20 or 30-minute ride home after work and you put your helmet on, there's no distractions. It's not like being in a car when you can still talk on the phone. You've got the radio. You might be eating crisps from the packet, reading the newspaper in traffic or you know, whatever it is. And so by the time you get home, you're still busy with work. Whereas on a motorbike or on a bicycle, you by the time you get home, your mind is clear and you're ready to meet your kids or meet your wife or meet whatever's coming next. And I think it's a real, really good mindfulness way.
Okay.
And then off to Africa. We got back on the bike after 2 years and went to Africa and then had a fucking massive crash again and really messed myself up at that time, you know.
So two broken hand and two broken legs isn't really messed up. The next one was
pretty big. I bent this arm backwards and all the bones came out, and I've had a big head injury and brain bleeds and brain swell, and broke my pelvis and had that plated, and broke my collarbone, had that and then broke all the ribs down my left side and punctured my lung and. Well, like, I don't remember anything. I just remember waking up in Hull Hospital and my wife was there and I was looking at him thinking, oh, fucking hell. And she was going, what the fuck have you done this time? You know, she was really pissed off.
Yeah.
And, so that was quite a bad one. And that was a big head injury. That really particular, I really wasn't right. Actually, my wife said, what do you mean weren't right? She said, never have been, really. But that took, you know, 4 or 5 months before I could even consider driving again. That right. It was awful, actually, having a concussion.
Yeah, I mean, but that's, you know, and then you've subsequently done another of your big trips after that, right? So the long way up.
Yeah, I've done another ones. Yeah, well, Long Way Up was after all of those.
Yeah.
And then there's a great book called Long Way Back, if you want to buy it. It's all about the crashes.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of it's extraordinary. I think it feels extraordinary to me that you could have a crash like that and within this time frame still be, you know, be walking here and sitting here with me and be as fine as you are. You know, I know things aren't perfect, but
yeah. No, I mean, I don't think I don't know. I mean, I remember when I first got back on my bike after the first crash. You know, I remember properly when I got on a bike properly. And I rode down the road. And I was crying. I was just so happy to, and it wasn't so happy about being back on a motorbike, but it was being back in life, you know, back to some form of normality. That's what really. And so the idea of being on a bike and being able to ride it was the what marked the beginning of the end of my recovery.
Hmm.
Did that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was such a milestone for me.
Yeah.
But I remember the other time when I was on the wheelchair, I thought, I can drive. And that was on the first one. So I went to my car and with the wheelchair, and I got in the car, no phone, no keys. I was just completely so excited that I thought I could do it. And I drove off down the road, rode around. I got back and someone had taken my parking space where my wheelchair was. So I was stuck in the car and I wasn't going to tell my wife that I'd gotten in the car. So then I had to stop outside the house and I had to beep on the horn until our front door opened up and my wife and my two daughters were there just looking at me as if just to say again, what the fuck are you doing? You know,
I'm starting to understand why they don't mind you going away for 4 months.
No, but, yeah, no. So get back on the bike was definitely part of the recovery.
I mean, it's crazily impressive as well as crazy.
Just yeah. Well, and plus the fact that's the only thing I really know how to do.
Yeah.
And to actually make any money is to actually ride a motorbike. So part of me, you know, doesn't really have a choice either. Yeah, one trick pony.
And so the latest, the long way up is the latest run is all on electric bike.
Yeah.
And it's been quite a while between those two mm-hmm. series, right?
Yeah, so. It was 12 years between two. I mean, I've been doing lots of other TV shows. I did the Dakar Rally. Made a TV show that broke my hands on that one, and then did all these loads of ones called Extreme Frontiers and travelled all over the place and stuff. And so we were always busy. Nguyen was just rocketing off as this A-lister, and he'd just moved to the States. So we were, and then every time he was coming over here to make a movie, I was always going somewhere else to do a TV show. So we just kept missing each other, and then we just hadn't seen each other in ages, and then I had that first big crash, and I remember someone, I think my wife rang you and said, look, you know, Charlie's had this big crash, you know, and then I think, and I remember Ewan was on his way to work, and he was just about to get on his motorbike to go to work and had this big crash, and it was like shit. And then he went to go to get his car keys. He thought, maybe I won't drive ride today. And then he stopped halfway through and he goes, no, Charlie would be furious if you got in the car. So he got back on the motorbike and rode off. And then he just thought, God, this is stupid. We just haven't really seen each other for ages. And then we started talking, you know, a bit more. And started talking about maybe doing another one. And then I had another crash, the second crash. And then he was over in London making a movie, and I was just recovering. I was sort of still, I'd been back in a wheelchair because I broke my pelvis. Anyway, he came over and he said, oh, can we come and stay for a couple of days just to say hi? And so they came, and then they ended up staying a month and couldn't get rid of him. Fucking hell. I mean, it was like, you know, so when is this film finished? And it was lovely having them there. And then we went away for a couple of weeks because we were going off somewhere, back to my father's house, and they stayed there, and we kind of made that connection again. And then we wanted to do a third one, but I don't think either of us really wanted to do it just on petrol bikes because we'd already done that.
Yeah.
And then it was Russ Malkin, one of the two producers on the TV show, said, you know, why don't you do it electric? And we thought, wow, the electric vehicles can't go anywhere. And then we thought, well, actually, why not? And then, you know, everyone says you can't do it, so it seemed like a good idea to do it. And there's this big thing. I'm sure all of you have that kind of, when you talk about electric vehicles, you talk about range anxiety.
Yeah.
And people get very stressed and they go, well, that Tesla will only do 300 miles. I couldn't possibly have a car that will only do 300 miles. And you go, well, how often do you actually fucking drive 300 miles in a day? And they go, well, I go to Cornwall. And you go, yeah, well, when was the last time you were in Cornwall? Well, 2 years ago. And so, you know, so I think there's lots of negativity about electric.
Yeah.
And I think if you're 35 plus, I think, you know, it's a big negative thing. I think if you're below 35, and my kids, you know, they don't give a shit what it is. And most of them don't even have a car. They just take Ubers and they wouldn't care if it was electric or they have no, you know, no, it's a very different concept of owning something is big. So we did it. And so now when people say, oh, I wouldn't have electric because you can't go anywhere. And you go, well, actually you can, you know.
So where was it? If this was up through America?
From the bottom of Argentina to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in the whole of South America, Central America and Mexico, there are no fast chargers. So we're just plugging in. But that made it really interesting because, you know, not only were we plugging into people's houses, but we were sort of plugging into their lives because you had to hang around for such a long time to let it charge. You were sort of having completely different... So whereas most of the time we'd spend in petrol stations, now we were just knocking around in people's houses. And that was it was a really nice experience. And because you could only go a certain distance each day because... of there are no fast chargers, you know, your whole outlook of how you traveled was completely different. So not only was it a different vehicle, but it was a completely different experience as yeah. well. It was very cool. It really was.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought I'd miss the petrol engine, but quickly you don't miss it at all, because you know suddenly you can hear the road, you can feel the road, because there's no vibration of the bike.
Right.
You feel speed and acceleration in a completely different way, because there isn't that big whining. You know, the more the engine revs, that suggests the faster you go. So, but there's none of that. So it's a completely different. So I'm not saying it's any better or any worse, but it's different, and it's cool.
And also, there's electricity everywhere, really, right?
Yeah.
So, like, there's not petrol everywhere. You know, there's a chance you could be. I know there are petrol stations, but you can usually find some electricity if you need to.
No, for sure. And you meet all sorts of people in a completely different way as well.
Yeah.
And then animals and stuff. I mean, you could pull up beside the road. I pulled up beside all these llamas, and because they weren't really making any noise, they didn't run away. They just hung out.
Right.
And they're quite pretty. They've got these beautiful eyes, big long eyelashes, and they sort of blink at you, you know, and you become mesmerized by them, you know.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary anxiety,
range anxiety syndrome isn't a new thing. And back in the day when petrol cars were just coming out, people had terrible range anxiety. So we'd leave, you know, I'd leave my house and then head to Guildford, which is down the road. I had a full tank of gas, but when I get to Guildford, there was almost no chance of getting petrol, because in the only places they would sell petrol when cars first came out was in chemists.
Right.
So you could only buy it. So people had terrible range anxiety. And then eventually petrol stations started to come around, and then people, you know, suddenly petrol was everywhere. And the same thing is sort of happening now, isn't it? There's a bit of money in electric vehicles. You know, suddenly you see chargers everywhere.
Yeah. Well, I've got an electric car, and I've never had to charge it outside of... I've not ever gone on a really long journey in it, but I've never had to charge it outside of my house.
Yeah.
I have done it a couple of times just to see how you do it, but I can drive to London and back. I can drive all the local stuff. It's really good.
And you must have felt really you were one of those little fuckers who were really smug in the last petrol crisis, sort of driving past, going.
I was doing these actually. It was a really weird thing because for 3 Mondays I drove past every petrol station between my house and here, and they were all closed. I don't know if they'd have opened up in the interim at all, or whether they've been closed for 3 weeks. But it did feel like, yeah, that is pretty pretty good. Although now all fuel's going to be so expensive, I'm not sure electricity's going to be any better. Charging it at home is going to be any better.
You know, with electricity now, you can charge your car, because you don't need to have it full all the time.
No.
So you can get these smart chargers now where you plug your car in, and it'll only charge the car on the cheap tariff between a certain hour and a certain hour. And so it's clever. And I noticed that, I don't know if you were knocking around London on the bicycle on that first lockdown, when there was just nothing around. And I remember going past Buckingham Palace I stopped, and it was beautiful sunny day, and it was blue sky. I'd never seen the sky so blue in London, and the air was so clean, and you could hear birds, and you could hear all this kind of stuff, and you suddenly had like a snapshot at what big cities would be like if the majority of the vehicles were electric. It would be that nice. So it's you know, it's actually not that bad.
No.
I don't think, you know.
No. Well, I think, you know, it's the way it's going to be going anyway, I think, which is, you know, it is very good. Have you got any other plans? Are you going on any more trips? Is there stuff coming up?
Yeah, I've got a few bits and pieces that I'm doing. I think Ewan and I have been talking about doing another one, and so that might happen in the next year or so. And then I've got something going on in Ireland this year, for this summer, which should be really fun. It involves motorcycles and a bit of cooking and a bit of culture and people. Because I grew up in Ireland, and that's where I kind of sort of first rode my motorbikes and stuff like that. I used to ride horses. I was a complete horse nut. And then a friend of mine had a motorbike, and I realised you didn't have to clean it, muck it up, feed it. You didn't. You could just you could ride it and beast it all day, and then just lean it up against the wall and go to go home. You know, it was a game changer. But so it's sort of back to my roots, I suppose, in Ireland.
Cool. Look, it's been absolutely lovely to talk to you both just now and the other podcast we're doing, which is going to be a new podcast coming out soon about. About testicles, losing testicles, and fantastic stuff in that as well, which we haven't really, I haven't really touched your testicles during this chat, hardly at all. But thank you so much for coming on. Ladies and gentlemen, give a massive round of applause to the incredible Charlie Borman.
Thank you very much.
Which one's which?
Thank you.
Thank you, mate. It's great. Thank you. Come back next week. We'll see you next week. You have been listening to Rahulasta Pub with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Charlie Borman. We look the same. It's confusing. Thank you to Scant Regard for playing the music for this bit here. It's nice. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. I'm indebted to the director, Chris Evans, not that one. I'm indebted to all of the crew, including incompetent Sandman George. He's the best one out of everyone. Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre for having us here and looking after us so nicely. Thank you as well to all the people who bet back the Kickstarter, who are and include Benjamin Molorn, that's not a real name, Soren Muller, Rachel Todd, Andy Lloyd, Steve Fowler, Joe and Phil Belcher, Mauricio Reyes, I reckon I got that, Jolly Mnemonic, Jenny Snow... Jenny Sloman, Ryan Krellin, Anonymous, David Luton, Ben Freeman, Tim Killen, Lewis Archer, or Louis Archer, Yes Please, Lizen Owen, Springsteen Fan, Christine James, Phil McCracken, Gillian Wallace, Steve Mitkowski, Richard Nicholson, Greg McLeod, John Burton, Mark Inman, Stuart Gunpowder, Martin Peck, James Lynn, Matt Leahy, pronounced Leahy, I got it right, not applicable, Matt Hoskins, Bouncy B. Hall, Adam Holman, and Liz Sweet Summer Manton. Crazy. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. You can watch the videos of these shows at gfsboxoffice.com for a small fee. You can also come and see these shows live. Go to richherring.com/gigs for more information of where Rahulasta will be on next. Become a badger at GoFasterStripe.com/badges. Thanks for listening. Go away.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It'll make me feel sad.